Yeah, sure. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, because just up past 12 o'clock. I'm Meghnad Desai. I'm a professor emeritus at London School of Economics, and I'm going to chair this meeting. I'm delighted to welcome my friend Gareth Evans, who is one of the pillars of the multilateral diplomatic world. He was foreign minister for Australia for a very, very long period of time. I'm not quite aware as long as Lord Palmerston or not, but a pretty long time. And actually, in a sense, Australia became a big player in the international field while Gareth was foreign minister. He's now in the International Crisis Group. And he was a member of the high-level group appointed by the Secretary General, for the UN Secretary General, to report on UN reforms. And so he has both theoretical and practical experience. And I'm delighted to welcome him, Gareth.
Well, thank you, Meghnad, for that gracious and mercifully brief introduction. Just one correction. I wasn't, in fact, foreign minister as long as Lord Palmerston. In fact, I wasn't now foreign minister as long as Alexander Downer, my successor. So that really is food for thought. But let's move on. Let me begin with the bad news about global governance, which is unfortunately easy enough to state. In every single area of governance which impacts most directly on people's lives, from peace and security, from violence, to poverty and hunger, to health, to education, to the sustainability of the environment, to the protection of human rights, the world last year earned failing grades, doing less than half of what was needed to achieve basically agreed goals. This was the conclusion of the World Economic Forum's Global Governance Initiative report, released at Davos last month, which scored global governance crudely but numerically in each area from 2 out of 10 to at most 4 out of 10. And it's a report, I think, that should have received more attention than it did. The agreed goals that this report was referring to are obvious or familiar enough. In the area of peace and security from violence, for example, they include an end to all existing wars within and between states and no new wars breaking out. In other areas of basic security, the goals mean doing what's necessary to meet the Millennium Development Goals, which include, you'll recall, the objectives by 2015 of halving present levels of extreme poverty and hunger, halting and reversing the spread of HIV/AIDS, malaria and TB, reducing child mortality by 2/3, mortality and the maternal mortality ratio by 3/4, and ensuring environmental sustainability, including halving the population of people without sustainable access to safe drinking water. It really should be intolerable in the world of the 21st century that there's still over 1 billion people living in extreme poverty, with life expectancy closer to 40 than the rich world's 80, and with 100 of every 1,000 children dying before their 5th birthday, compared with less than 10 in high-income countries. But it's abundantly clear that at the present rate of progress, the Millennium Development Goals, modest as they are when you think of the scale of the human misery that would still remain when they were achieved, are simply not going to be met. Moreover, it's abundantly clear how much remains to do to get the world back on track in other areas of governance concern. Given, for example, the long history of failure throughout the 1990s to get it right on the question of so-called humanitarian intervention, from the lamentable inaction in response to the Rwandan genocide in 1994 through to the action in Kosovo in 1999, which was defensible enough in principle, but, as you know, unsupported by the Security Council. There's been the resurgence, which we all know about, of unilateralist sentiment and behaviour, culminating in the coalition invasion of Iraq in 2003, the defenders of which seem for the most part to remain resolutely unchastened by the subsequent course of events. There's the loss of confidence that we can see all around us in governing circles in the existence and vitality of the rules applicable to the use of force, including in particular the assertion we've seen of a much more wide-ranging right than ever previously acknowledged, to use preventively the power to act in self-defence. There's the absence of any apparent institutional capacity or willingness at a global level to deal with the problem of failed, failing and fragile states, a recurring element in explaining the resonance and the reality of most classes of contemporary security threats. There's the lack of support by key countries for international treaty regimes and multilateral institutions, and there's the manifest dysfunctionality of a number of intergovernmental organisations like the Human Rights Commission, ECOSOC, in many ways the UN Secretariat itself, with the question of the efficiency and accountability of the Secretariat now crystallised by the controversy over the administration of the Oil for Food programme. Well, that's all the bad news. The good, or at least the better news, is that this year, 2005, is emerging as the one in which all of this can be turned around, with the UN and other key elements in the multilateral system beginning to be wrenched into the shape they need to be to confront all the challenges of security and development that the world and its peoples are facing now and will for decades ahead. Maybe it's naive of me to say so, perhaps even dementedly optimistic to say so, but it does seem to me that just about all the relevant stars are for once in alignment. We know very well where the weak points and the stresses are in the international system. There's no shortage of analysis, including from my own organisation, the International Crisis Group, as to what's going wrong. We know what we need to do to get things right. There's no shortage of major reports now laying out prescriptions and agendas for the necessary change. Above all, the two on which I'll be concentrating today, that's to say the report of the Secretary-General's high-level panel on 21st century security threats, which was released in December, and Jeffrey Sachs's Millennium Project report, which was released just last month. Again, we know we have, as a global community, if not always individually, the available resources and the capacity to do what we need to do if those resources are properly directed. We have, furthermore, the occasion this year for a major change effort with the 60th anniversary of the United Nations and all the high-level meetings and summitry that's associated with that. And, although this is probably the most optimistic bit of all, given the speed with which memories of even the worst horrors fade, we may just even have the final crucial ingredient for something to happen, and that's to say the spark, the catalyst, the political will, triggered by the catastrophic Indian Ocean tsunami, which did, I think, demonstrate, as perhaps nothing else could, that we are indeed one human family, exposed to ever-increasing common risks and sharing the responsibility to tackle them. Well, certainly there's a flurry of activity now going on, mainly in the lead-up to the UN 60th anniversary session and the Millennium Review Summit, attended by heads of government that will precede it, but also in the context, for example, of the forthcoming Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference, all of which activity is aimed at identifying strategies for change and actually creating the momentum to make them possible. Well, 60-year-olds are notoriously unreformable, as I can personally testify, being precisely that disconcerting age myself. And the task ahead is obviously formidable indeed for anyone who would seek to transform the UN and the other major elements of the global order put into place after the Second World War into now a fully effective, efficient and equitable institutional system. But I do sense that 2005 really is a make or break year for global governance, and that if we don't begin to make some major policy and institutional changes this year, the onset of senile decay in the multilateral system is going to be very rapid indeed. Let me talk about the high-level panel report. Released as it was in December, this report, called A More Secure World, Our Shared Responsibility, was above all an attempt to recover credibility for collective security and to recover traction for cooperative internationalism rather than unilateralism and all that that implies. The panel's recommendations were both substantive and unanimous, which was a pretty important achievement given the extraordinarily diverse, highly experienced and accordingly very strong-minded makeup of the group, including, as it did among its 16 members, such well-known figures as Gro Brundtland, Sadako Agata, Yevgeny Primakov, Amr Moussa, Salim Salim, Lord David Hannay, and Brent Scowcroft, along with some rather less exalted ones like me. Our recommendations were also rather numerous, 101 of them, in fact, in a report of 93 pages. Some have taken the view that that was vulgar excess, but I like to think of that reaction as being no better merited than Emperor Joseph's famous response after hearing, you recall, Mozart's first opera in Vienna, when he said, "No doubt a very fine piece of music, Mr. Mozart, but too many notes." Well, no doubt you'll make your own judgment, although it'll have to be on the basis of a few selected passages. This is not the occasion to take you through the entire score. The panel's approach was to begin by identifying the six major categories of security threats that the world will confront in the decades ahead. War within states, still, war between states, weapons proliferation, terrorism, organized crime, and as a separate basket, the human security threats posed by poverty, disease, and environmental crisis. We sought to explain the interconnections between these threats and the extent to which there have been shortfalls in performance in responding to them. Then, for each of the threats in question, we outlined preferred policy solutions with a strong emphasis throughout on prevention, but also making clear the circumstances in which, if prevention failed, the use of force might be defensible and unavoidable. And we concluded by making a number of quite specific recommendations for institutional change, not for its own sake, but where we felt this was critically necessary if we are to do as an international community a better job in meeting the range of threats that we're going to continue to confront. Just to give you a flavour of some of the preventive strategies that we recommended, on preventing deadly conflict within and between states, for example, we argued for better and more effective regulatory frameworks and legal and judicial regimes dealing with impunity and so on, to ensure there won't be impunity in the future, including the International Criminal Court, which we strongly supported in a way that won't be very musical to Washington's ears. We argued for better information and analysis being available to the UN, more effective mediation, professional mediation, through rather better trained and generally better chosen special representatives and envoys. As to the world's most dangerous weapons, we argued that there was a very real concern about a cascade of proliferation, as we put it, occurring in the years ahead, requiring a four-layered response. Attention in the first place to the familiar supply side issues, that's to say curbing the availability of fissile material and technology, but also secondly on the demand side, addressing the issues that actually motivate states to acquire nuclear and other weapons, everything from real security threats to perceived double standards in arms control regimes. We argued thirdly for a layer of response which involved better strategies to enforce verification compliance, and a fourth strategy, probably the only one available in the context realistically biological weapons, and that's better public health defences. On the subject of terrorism, we argued for a new definition of terrorism, namely violent action, well, an agreed definition of terrorism. It's not new, but there's been disagreement about it in the UN system for umpteen years, and that's inhibited the development of any real normative drive from the UN system in addressing this problem. And we got unanimous agreement, interestingly, to define terrorism essentially as violent action against civilians or other non-combatants for essentially political motives, something which has been very difficult to get agreement about because of the freedom fighter issue and so on. We also agreed, I think more importantly, even than that, in the context of terrorism, to the necessity for a comprehensive policy approach, extending not just to policing, intelligence, and ultimately military action, but really addressing underlying root causes, in particular acute political grievances. In many ways, the heart of the high-level panel report was not just its stuff on prevention, but on the recommendations we came to as to the rules and principles governing the use of military force. What should happen when countries or peoples are threatened by invasion or by terrorist attack or by mass internal violence? And in those circumstances, all non-forcible preventive measures all seem to have failed. The report addressed quite squarely every one of the issues that have divided the international community in recent years, arguing, basically, that any use of force must satisfy very tough criteria of both legality and legitimacy. On legality, we made clear for a start that the scope of permissible unilateral self-defence is in fact very limited. Article 51 of the UN Charter says a state can act in self-defence without going to the Security Council in the case of actual armed attack. In addition to that, there's 200 years of international law practice which really extends that to imminently apprehended attack, not actual but imminently apprehended. And we said both of those circumstances were justifiable, but that's where legality runs out. Preemptive self-defense, yes, in cases of imminent threat, may be justified, but so-called preventive self-defense in relation to a threat which is not imminent but distant in time, however real it may be, is not. If someone, for example, somewhere is building a nuclear reactor which you think is ultimately going to make bombs directed at you, there might be the scope, there might even be the necessity for military action to be taken against that threat. But that's a matter for the Security Council. For any one country to be able to interpret the right of self-defense so broadly is to open the gates for everyone to do the same. And that way lies anarchy. On the other hand, the report makes clear that Chapter 7 of the UN Charter does fully empower the Security Council to itself authorize the use of force in just about any situation whatever, where it determines that some threat to international peace and security, whether that response is preventive, whether it's reactive, whether it's in relation to external threats, or whether it's in relation to internal threats in the exercise of so-called international community's responsibility to protect its most vulnerable peoples, so-called humanitarian intervention. It's squarely acknowledged by the panel in what might be a rather more musical tune for Washington's ears that it may be necessary in some circumstances for the Security Council to authorize military action preventively against a threat which is real but not in any way imminent. For example, the nuclear reactor case that I just mentioned. But having said all that, we certainly don't stop there. Legality is only part of the story. There's always also a question about legitimacy. The common sense, the reasonableness, the sanity, the morality of actually taking action which might be technically legal. And here the contribution the panel has made, I think, is a very important one, identifying, as we did, five criteria of legitimacy that should be satisfied before any decision is ever made to go to war. Very briefly, those criteria are these. First, seriousness of the threat. Is the threat of harm to state or human security of a kind which is sufficiently clear and serious to justify prima facie the use of military force? Secondly, proper purpose. Is it clear that the primary purpose of the proposed military action is actually to halt or avert the threat in question, whatever other purposes or motives might be involved, and perhaps usefully so for domestic political consumption to give you the capacity to act? Last resort, thirdly, has every non-military option for meeting the threat in question actually been explored with reasonable grounds for believing that other measures won't succeed? It doesn't mean that you have to, in time, work your way physically through those other options. It does mean, however, that the decision makers have to be satisfied on reasonable grounds that no non-forcible action would in fact succeed. Fourthly, proportionality. Is the scale, the duration, the intensity of the proposed military action the minimum necessary to meet the threat in question? And finally, very importantly, balance of consequences. Is there a reasonable chance of the military action actually being successful in meeting the threat in question, with the consequences of the action not being likely to be worse than the consequences of inaction? The panel agreed unanimously, again, that these criteria should be adopted as guidelines by the Security Council in a formal declaratory resolution, and indeed adopted as well by the General Assembly. The point about them, and we say this in so many words, is not that they will produce, they can't, with any kind of push-button inevitability, clear-cut agreement in every case. The argument is simply that over time, and with the pressure that the very existence of these criteria will create for states to publicly explain and defend their positions, there will be more likelihood of consensus being achieved, both as to what are the proper cases to go to war and, of course, what are the proper cases not to go to war. and less likelihood as a result that states will want to bypass the Security Council entirely and put at risk the whole collective security system. On the question of institutional reform, most public attention has focused inevitably on what we had to say about restructuring the Security Council on the basis that not to have an India, a Japan, a Brazil, any major African country guaranteed a regular presence on the world's preeminent body for deciding great issues of war and peace is to have a Security Council that is not remotely representative of the balances of credible power and authority and contribution in the world as it is today. The report comes up with two clear, self-contained, votable alternative models for achieving that representativeness. Neither of the models, importantly, would extend the veto to any new members, and both would increase the numbers of Security Council members from 15 to 24, with each of the world's four major geographical regions having six seats each: the Americas, North and South, Europe, East and West, Africa, and Asia and the Pacific. The difference between the two models comes down to the way in which the major countries would be represented. Model A, as we proposed it, provides for six new permanent seats, with the new ascendance to heaven coming two from Asia, not identified by us, but presumably Japan and India, two from Africa, presumably will be a product of a contest between Nigeria, South Africa and Egypt, one from the Americas, presumably Brazil, and one from Europe, presumably Germany. Model B, by contrast, provides for no new permanent seats, but creates a new category of renewable four-year terms, with two such seats for each of the four major geographical regions again, thus allowing for some degree of negotiated rotation, with a possible place in the sun for next-tier countries like Mexico or Pakistan or Italy or Spain, and also, importantly, the chance for some accountability to be applied to the major occupants. You can probably imagine the lustiness of the politics now being waged in capitals and New York corridors around this issue at the moment. Members of the panel were hardly unaware of the capacity of this issue to distract attention from the other substantive matters in our report. We just hope that that distraction won't be total and that the issue will be reasonably swiftly resolved. There's a fair chance that that will be the case, because states do seem to have a dawning sense, although admittedly the sun has yet to come up for a few of them, of just what a watershed year this is and how important it is that a full range of issues be addressed. In addition to Security Council reform, other major institutional changes that we proposed include the following. First of all, creation of one wholly brand new institution, a peace-building commission, to address very specifically the generic problem of failed, failing and fragile states, particularly but not only in the context of post-conflict peace building. The idea is to create a new structure as a subsidiary organ of the Security Council, not necessarily reflecting the membership of the Security Council but having its authority, which would bring together the relevant UN organs and agencies, the relevant major donors, the international financial institutions, the bank and the fund and the regional banks and so on, relevant regional organisations and relevant bilateral donors, to address in a systematic, coherent, focused, sustained way the full range of policy responses to state fragility and failure with which we are now so familiar. Again, we proposed a variety of measures to create a more competent and professional UN secretariat with much greater management flexibility vested in the Secretary General, who must right now be the most micromanaged chief executive in any organisation, public or private, in the world. He should have the capacity to put people where they're needed and then, of course, be fully accountable, fully transparent in those decisions, subject to full auditing exercise after the event. We also argue that he should be supported by a new position of Deputy Secretary General for coordinating peace and security affairs. We also propose a number of measures to make less dysfunctional some of those organs within the UN system, ECOSOC, the Commission on Human Rights, the General Assembly itself, for example, which are these days, unfortunately, none of them at the heart of serious policy making or serious norm setting. At the very least, their internal processes must be reformed to prioritise issues and ensure real engagement on the great issues of the day, rather than just stylised point scoring. some hope, you might say, but we've made some suggestions as to how that might happen. In the particular case of ECOSOC, which a great many people have been arguing for a great many years should be transmogrified into some kind of economic security council sitting up there alongside the present security council and exercising real macroeconomic coordination authority, the panel took the rather hard-headed view that too many functions had now been irretrievably lost, for better or worse, from the UN system to the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO, and for that matter the G8 and the G20 finance ministers, for this any longer to be a realistic option. But we thought it was highly desirable, and indeed realistic, for ECOSOC to become a serious world development cooperation forum, regularly discussing at a ministerial and indeed sometimes head of government level, rather than the present second or third secretary level, the interlinkages between development and trade and finance, the environment and social issues, which are so important. We also argued, again, for stronger support for regional security organisations like the African Union and for their better coordination integration with other institutions in the collective security system, although not making this an excuse for any abdication of responsibility where that continues to be necessary by the global security institutions. So much for the high-level panel report. The SACS report, this is the other big one setting the global governance agenda for 2005 and beyond. The product of a team of some 250 researchers headed by Columbia's Professor Jeffrey Sachs. It sets a human security agenda on really a breathtaking scale in some 13 volumes totaling over 2,700 pages, mercifully summarised in an overview document of just 74 pages. But it outlines strategies which, if successful, claimed would result by 2015 in an extraordinary list of goods, more than 500 million people being lifted out of extreme poverty, more than 300 million no longer suffering from hunger, 30 million children being saved who would otherwise die before their fifth birthday, 2 million mothers' lives being saved, 350 million fewer people living without safe drinking water, 650 million fewer people living without basic sanitation. The strategies that are identified in the SACS report are really pretty straightforward and do seem deliverable, albeit not without some pain. I won't review the whole spectrum of them, but those half dozen with a longer time frame involve these. First of all, specific Millennium Development Goal-based poverty reduction strategies being adopted by developing countries to anchor the scaling up of public investments, capacity building, domestic resource mobilization, and official development assistance, ODA. Secondly, high-income countries scaling up their ODA from the present current overall figure of 0.25% of donor GNP to 0.44% in 2006 and 0.54% in 2015, still less, it will be noticed, than the 0.7% figure to which countries are presently supposed to aspire and which five countries, all of them European, have in fact already exceeded. Again, the strategy is recommended is for high-income countries, of course, to open their markets to developing country exports through the completion of the Doha Round negotiations no later than 2006. For international donors to mobilise support for global scientific research and development to address specific needs of the poor countries in the areas of health, agriculture, environmental management, energy and climate. $7 billion worth of that by 2015 being proposed. And then a whole variety of methods proposed for the UN system to strengthen the coordination of its agencies and funds and programmes and country support teams working with the international financial institutions. In addition to these longer-term strategies, the SACS report recommends very interestingly and intriguingly the immediate launch in 2005 of quite a long list of quick-win actions that could, in fact, work extremely swiftly to save and improve millions of lives. You've been reading about some of these because they generated enthusiasm from film stars and pop stars, but one of them is the free mass distribution, and Tony Blair, of course, not in the same category, free mass distribution of malaria bed nets and effective anti-malaria medicines for all children in regions of malaria transmission by the end of 2007, a cost of just $500 million a year to achieve all of that. and again, successful completion of the so-called 3x5 campaign to bring 3 million AIDS patients in developing countries onto antiretroviral treatment by the end of 2005, and that would be at a total cost of some $5 billion. The figures involved in all these initiatives and strategies, both long-term and short-term, are not small. But when it comes to the issue of available resources to spend on these global public goods, the point is always the same. Individually, countries may not have the necessary capacity or anything like it, and the same indeed may be true of whole regions or whole sub-regions. But the world as a whole certainly has that capacity, and the rich countries certainly have that capacity. It's just a question of what we choose to spend those resources on. I think the response to the Indian Ocean tsunami is a very illuminating example. Because people could immediately relate to the catastrophe, because they saw so much of it in almost real time in the media, because people from so many different countries in so many parts of the world, some 40 in all, were directly affected by the death and suffering involved, both government and private hearts and wallets did open to an unprecedented extent. In the first 3 weeks, you remember, over $7 billion was pledged, with my own Australian government topping the table, actually, with over $800 million, and Germany and other European countries and the EU itself being extraordinarily generous, especially in per capita terms. The wealthiest country in the world, the United States, produced a sizable $350 million from the government and another $650 million from its private citizens, hardly stingy in absolute terms, but not as generous as many others. The total per capita contribution from the US as of mid-January was $3.54 per person as compared to Norway's $57.95 and Australia's, for once, $44.90. What most commentators focused on, however, were not so much the comparisons between the US and other countries, but the US's own internal expenditure priorities. Was perhaps a little bit unkind of Democrat Senator Leahy to say of Washington's initial contribution of $35 million that, quote, we spend $35 million before breakfast in Iraq each day. But it is true that even the later contribution of $350 million does represent just 2.5 days of the US's additional military expenditure in Iraq at its present rate of just about $1 billion a week. It's also true to say that it represents less than 0.1% of the total US military budget, now running at around $450 billion a year, just under half the world's total. The tsunami example is perhaps a special case of which too much should not be made. But the scale of US military expenditure does put into, I think, a useful perspective even the very large sums identified as being necessary by Jeffrey Sachs and his team, if the world as a whole is to meet every one of the Millennium Development Goals in every country in the world. That would cost, on his estimation, $121 billion in 2006, rising to $135 billion in 2015. Next year's global expenditure, in other words, would be around 1/8 of what the world is currently spending on its militaries, and not much more than 1/4 of the US's own defence budget. So clearly, soft power has some distance to go before it rivals hard power as a priority for the world's policy makers. Let me come now in the last section to the politics of change. If 2005 is to be the watershed year for global governance that we want it to be, the clear need now is to bring together in a coherent and effective way both the peace and the development agendas that I've been outlining, the Millennium Development Goals agenda laid out in the Sachs report and the broader state and human security and institutional reform agenda mapped in the high-level panel report. The Secretary-General's intention is to prepare the ground in this respect for the Heads of Government Millennium Review Summit in September. By bringing together in a single short document that he will submit to those heads next month, the key recommendations of both reports. Intensive consultations are going on right now as to what will be in the Secretary-General's report. And it's too early to make judgments about which of the major proposals from the two reports will fly and which will not survive even this early cut. My strong hope, I have to say, is that the international political debate will be allowed to run its full course without the Secretary-General and those advising him yielding ground too early or too easily on recommendations on which disagreement emerges. In this context, I have been pleasantly surprised so far by the extent of the positive reaction to both reports, and the high-level panel report in particular, which after all treads in many ways much more sensitive and controversial ground. And I've been surprised by the and impressed, pleased by the seriousness with which the reports are being taken by all major governments, all of whom are studying them carefully at the moment, without too many strong negatives so far publicly emerging. Whether the rest of the world likes it or not, we know that much will ultimately ride on the attitude of the United States. And so far, the news is not bad. Within the administration, intensive interagency work is proceeding across the full range of issues identified in the high-level panel report. And Congress, on the initiative of Republican Representative Frank Wolf, has in fact just established a bipartisan task force, co-chaired, interestingly, by former Republican Speaker Newt Gingrich, but also by former Democrat Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell, which includes in its ranks, along with much more conservative figures, some formidable liberal internationalists like Wes Clark, former ambassadors Tom Pickering, Don McHenry, and Anne-Marie Slaughter of Princeton. Coordinated through the US Institute of Peace, that task force is mandated to report in June. And our breath will certainly be bated. I've described how, at the international level, it's intended to move forward the main proposals as a matter of process. But the question still arises, as always, as to how the politics of all this will be managed. And in this respect, there are, among friends of the reform process, two rather distinct schools of thought, which might be labelled respectively the grand bargain school and the we're all in this together school. The grand bargain approach starts from the premise that there are essentially two quite distinct sets of security concerns that are in issue here. The hard security set, so-called, focused around the threats posed by terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, proliferation, organised crime, and to some rather less extent war between and within states, which are primarily of interest to the countries of the North. And then the so-called soft security set focused overwhelmingly on the human security threats posed by poverty, starvation, environmental degradation, and other failures more generally to meet the Millennium Development Goals that are said to be primarily of interest to the countries of the South. Against this, the idea, in essence, is that a bargain or trade-off be sought in which the countries of the North meet the dollar costs of the South's priorities while the South countries give the necessary political support in the Security Council, regional organisations and at national government level to the tough regulatory and enforcement measures demanded by the North in the pursuit of its own security priorities. The alternative approach, which I personally favour, is to argue that the truth of the is to argue the truth of the matter is that we are in all of this together in the contemporary world, that we bear the risks together and that we bear a shared responsibility to find and implement solutions. However much different security threats might resonate differently in different parts of the world, reflecting differences in geography, in power and in wealth, nonetheless, the argument goes, none of us can escape ultimately the impact of any of them. The tsunami natural disaster occurring in the south still killed thousands from the north. Terrorist outrages have killed more people, in fact, in developing countries from Kenya to Iraq to Indonesia than they have in the north. A nuclear weapons exchange by accident or design is as likely to kill millions, of course, in the south as the north. Health pandemics like HIV/AIDS have distressed the whole world. The economic and social impact of refugee outflows has affected northern countries almost as much as countries in the south, and so on and on. The problem with the grand bargain approach is not necessarily the tinge of cynicism that runs through it. Those of us who've been in politics a long time tend to like anything that works, being guided by Deng Xiaoping's maxim that it doesn't matter whether the cat is black or white as long as it catches the mouse. It may be that there will be some in the corridors of New York who will find a deal-cutting approach of this kind familiar, comfortable, indeed productive. The concern is partly that the bargain would in fact not proved to be workable, never really being able to be implemented in practice, with the packages being putatively traded, being so hugely different in character and being deliverable over such different time frames. But I think even more substantially, the concern is that the grand bargain approach is based on a quite false premise and is just not inherently plausible. The really critical need is to change the mindset of policymakers and those who influence them, to get everyone to recognise that cooperative internationalism really is the name of the game, and that it really is in everyone's interest to move forward simultaneously on all elements of the reform agenda, on both the peace and the development sides. One final set of strictures, though. In trying to do this, however, and to build a real consensus for change, it is important for multilateralists, those of us passionate about improving the instruments of international cooperation, not to overstate our case, especially to those both in the First World and the Third World who are not so easy to persuade. It's important to recognise, for a start, as the high-level panel put it, that the frontline actors in dealing with all the threats we face, both new and old, do continue to be individual sovereign states whose role and responsibilities and right to be respected are fully recognised in the UN Charter. The principle of subsidiarity, in fact, runs through both the high-level panel and the SACS reports, the notion that while not a substitute for collective global responsibility, more responsibility has to be exercised at the individual country and regional level. It's also important to recognise that not every security problem has a UN or an immediate UN solution. Sometimes, as with Aceh disaster relief in the first hours and days, it's a matter of direct government action rather than working through some international coordinating mechanism which may be slow to get established. Similarly with conflict resolution, every situation does have its own dynamic and its own best institutional solution. When it comes to negotiating a way through the North Korean or the Iranian nuclear standoffs, or finding a way to the longed-for Palestinian settlement, or facilitating peace talks in Nepal, the critical roles may need to be played by individual countries, or by small groups of them, or by regional organisations, or by non-government mediators, not necessarily acting under UN auspices. And again, with institutional effectiveness generally, multilateralists do no service to the cause by loving intergovernmental structures but leaving them inefficient and ineffective. We have to acknowledge that the UN Secretariat, many of its organs and agencies, and most regional organisations are ripe for far-reaching reform. But all that said, all those strictures given, the bottom line must be universal and unequivocal acceptance of the UN Charter as setting the ultimate rules of international behaviour, particularly when it comes to the use of military force, whether in self-defence or in the defence of others. As the high-level panel insisted, if there are weaknesses in the present collective security system, the task is not to seek alternatives to the present institutions, but to make them work better. A final positive note, the evidence since the Cold War ended is that cooperative security efforts do bear fruit. For all that has so often gone wrong with Security Council decision-making, and with peacemaking, and with peacekeeping, and with peace-building operations, and God knows there's a lot that's gone wrong, there have been, in the new century so far, just, sounds a lot, but wait for the comparison. In the new century so far, there's been 20,000 to 30,000 people each year suffering violent deaths in wars within and between states. But that is to be compared with over 200,000 a year suffering violent deaths from war between or within states in the 1990s. It's been an extraordinary reduction over time. An enormous amount of that can, I believe, be directly attributed to the big strides forward that have been made over the last 15 years in cooperative diplomacy and peace operations. There are similarly plenty of good news stories on the development side about countries and regions and strategies which have spectacularly succeeded. And those stories are much drawn upon, properly so, by the SACS report in pointing a new way forward. We have to hope that from the various channels of action that will follow from the high-level panel and SACS reports, something really major will happen. The stakes are very high. There are plenty who are sceptical that the multilateral system, the UN organisation itself, and the major states who actually, of course, determine so much of what happens, there are plenty who are sceptical that these would ever be capable, separately or together, of even beginning to respond to the challenges these reports have identified. But my very last word is this: we have no alternative. The truth of the matter is that we've run out of choices. As the world learned, very much to its cost, when the League of Nations fell apart in the 1930s, if we didn't have an effective global collective security institution, we'd simply have to reinvent one all over again. So let's start with what we've got. Let's make the system work. The big reports that have been published in the last 3 months have shown the way forward. It's now up to political leaders and those who influence them, among whom I hope the LSC still ranks, to deliver. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that, Gareth. Now, we'll have some time for questions. Are there roaming mics? There are two roaming mics. And so wait till you get the mic. And as I always say, ask a question, don't give me a speech.
Do okay. They listen?
Oh, I shouted them. don't worry. No, I mean, you haven't seen me in that action yet. Okay. There is someone here, and then Mary Caldor, and then somebody here at the front. Okay. Gentleman here. Maybe let's do a second one here so we can get a can then Mary. Yeah.
Thank you. In the recommendation, is there any alternative financing schedule for a new UN? Maybe if United States doesn't want to support it.
Do you want to collect some of these?
Let me look at a few questions, yeah. No, I think I'm in the gentleman here. Thank you.
Two quick questions. I just wanted to hear the justification behind not extending veto rights to new members of the Security Council. And there was no mention of any Middle Eastern states being added to the Security Council other than potentially Egypt. Again, wondering what the justification behind that is.
Okay. That lady after that, Mary Caldor over there.
Well, congratulations on the report, and especially your own role with all the responsibility to protect and those legal criteria. I just wanted to ask you about your definition of human security, because this is something we're very preoccupied with. You seem to suggest that human security is a soft issue, about economic and development causes. We define human security as a hard issue, about a hard and soft, actually, about the security of individuals and communities as opposed to the security of the states. And nowadays, with organized crime, terrorism, political violence, it's individuals that are the problem. So I'm wondering, am I mishearing you? And also, I felt there wasn't there a little bit of a gap on that side. Somehow you had the military side and the development side. But what I wanted to know was, where was this sort of combination of policing, military and civil that, for instance, Brahimi talked about?
Okay, thanks. Lady there.
I was wondering if you could talk about humanitarian intervention and the use of force, because it's not... in the UN Charter, there's not specific mention of it. If there's any talk of movement toward coming to a common definition on that as it applies to the use of force.
Okay, can I?
Gentleman there, just one more. Gentleman okay. There.
This summer, the UK government hosts the G8 meeting and takes on the EU presidency. The two issues that I'm aware of that they've highlighted are the future of Africa and climate change. And I just wonder how you feel, if you have any thoughts or any advice for the British government as to how they can play a beneficial role in the process and the priorities that you're setting.
Okay, let's take those five questions and then we'll come back to more.
First question, is there any new recommendations here about a financing mechanism, resources issues and all of this? No, there's not, and I think that's a weakness in our report, which I, for one, was a bit anxious about. I mean, some of these issues have been very well addressed in the Zedillo report on financing for development not so long ago. There are a number of live issues out there, of course, most recently stimulated again by President Chirac opening up rather quixotically the issue of international taxation, Tobin taxes and airline taxes and all the rest of it. which unfortunately don't seem to have much of a market. The truth of the matter is that most of the recommendations that we were making in the high-level panel report are not especially expensive in raw terms. The real money comes when you move into the Sachs report issues and the kinds of billions of dollars that there need to be mobilised. But again, the truth of the matter is that when you start comparing the sums of money involved with other avenues of expenditure, they really do come into a perspective. They are affordable. It's just a matter of the will to do it. So whether we need sexy new international mechanisms or whether we just need some forms of better incentive for national governments to provide, you know, global public goods for which there are always going to be free riders and so on is a real issue, and maybe it should have been addressed. There are some other weaknesses in the report. I don't think we addressed the judicial issues about international court structures and so on, and to the extent that we should have and the way that we should have. But that's that. As to veto rights, why didn't we extend veto rights to any of the new members? Very simply because there's no market for that whatsoever anywhere in the world, apart from the potential ascendance to heaven themselves, where there's a very strong market, but very limited. There's about 8 or 9 of those who would love to be in that category, and about 190 other countries who don't think that's a very good idea at all. A stronger question, a harder one to answer, is why we didn't argue for the actual deletion of veto rights from the present 5. And the short answer for that, again, unfortunately, there's no market for that in the present 5. And unfortunately, they're the ones that exercise the veto power as to whether there should be any reduction in their veto power. And if you were concerned to get some consensus and get something happening to give the whole Security Council greater legitimacy, we just had to be hard-headedly realistic on that front and put that one on the back burner for another day. I mean, the truth of the matter is the only reason we got a UN even in 1945 was by giving the veto to the United States. It would not otherwise have come into it. That remains true in spades today. I suspect it will remain true in another 60 years or another 100 years. And that might just be the price we have to pay always to have multilateral institutions at all that have some teeth. Mary Kelder's question about human security, I was careful to use the phrase pure human security issues when I referred to poverty, disease, environmental degradation and so on, because I for one certainly regard issues of violence and suffering from violence in war between and within states and from terrorism and so on as being unequivocally human security issues. The question is, as always when you talk about human security, does it actually help much in advancing the political debate, or does it help much to operationalise solutions? When you look at the Senegata report on the whole subject of human security, you know, it wasn't a bad exercise in just sort of consciousness raising that these issues are out there, but the concept was used so loosely and comprehensively, as you would, I think, acknowledge, Mary, that it didn't actually help much in leading to any particular form of decision-making. I think it is important for people to understand that when we use the expression security these days, we're certainly not just talking about state security in the old 1945 sense when the huge preoccupation was about states waging aggressive war and not much else. We are talking about the impact of this on people. We are looking at a lot of these things from a victim perspective, a people perspective. And it's very important to have that language conceptually out there. But whether it helps all that much to agonise about definitions, I don't know, because there's not really an awful lot that follows from saying that one way of characterising this is a human security issue. If it really did help to mobilise political constituencies and governments, that's great, and more power to your arm in trying to do so. But, you know, I'm just not quite so sure. Human security is one context, of course, in which humanitarian intervention, the case is very much helped for getting agreement about the necessity and legitimacy of humanitarian intervention by characterising it in human security terms and recognising that the real issue here is the suffering of people as a result of the inability of their own states to protect them, or in fact the ill will of their own states towards them. What we're really talking about here is something that is squarely on the human security agenda. It's got nothing to do with the old traditional state security agenda, and it is important in this context to recognise that the Charter extends just as much to that concern, and not only in the context of traditional development objectives. Where we are at in this respect is, I think, there's a quite important step forward has been made by the high-level panel embracing the concept and language of humanitarian intervention
in the form of this concept of responsibility to protect, with which I had something to do with the previous Canadian commission that I chaired that Meghdad referred to. It's a fascinating exercise, I think, in intellectual history to watch the way in which this idea has evolved and gradually taken hold. When we started out addressing the issue in the 90s, it was in the context of a huge international debate, huge angst as to whether it was ever proper for the Security Council, for the international community to get involved in internal affairs, whatever the scale of the horror that was being perpetrated, because of the argued force of Article 2.7 of the Charter, non-interference in internal affairs. And a lot of that debate was being fueled by the way in which the argument was being put, with those countries and people who wanted to intervene talking about a right to intervene, the right of humanitarian intervention. What we succeeded in doing, I think, with the ICUS report was to turn that concept on its head and talk and say that the issue is really not about the right to intervene, but the responsibility to protect. Responsibility of sovereign governments, first of all, yes, but when that sovereignty is abdicated or abandoned through ill will or incapacity, that responsibility shifts to the wider international community. And interestingly, that gained a real toehold. It did start to impact the debate, now, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where it articulated a view of the world which was evolving anyway, much less so in Latin America and Asia, where there's much more neuralgia still about sovereignty issues. But what happened when we got to the high-level panel report, against that background and the stage at which the debate had reached, it was a very much easier sell to get even this disparate group of people on the panel to agree to this than I think would have otherwise been the case. It was a classic example of the way in which ideas do matter, because they do gain hold, they do affect the way in which people think about it, and it just changes the language of the debate. Now, we've still got some distance to go before we translate what is still at best just an emerging norm into a rule of customary international law, let alone a treaty rule, but we sure as hell are getting there. And I think this is a very important development. I was asked finally about climate change and the Africa Mission exercise. I think they fit both of those initiatives extraordinarily cleanly within the Jeffrey Sachs report agenda, and I believe they will be given the policy goals associated with those two big issues. Will be very clearly articulated in the Secretary General's summary recommendations that are going forward, and rightly so. I think it did help for the G8 to Tony Blair to take leadership on this issue. It did help for the issue to be given the kind of attention it was in Davos, for example, this year. And I think these are concepts, the Africa one in particular, and we're still struggling with climate change, but they are issues that are going forward and about which momentum is developing, and rightly so.
Okay, quickly now. I won't have time for that many questions. The lady back there in red, and then the gentleman in front of
you. You talked about the pledges for the tsunami victims, and I was wondering, and we have seen the year before, is that working? Year before, what happened in Iran and how much money of the pledges was actually paid. I think the same problem rises with the Millennium Development Goals. So how do we make sure that the pledges by the governments are actually paid?
Okay, lady here. In a minute. Lady here, let me take lady. Yeah.
Thank you. You stressed the importance of the legality of the use of force. Does this mean you think there should not have been an intervention in Kosovo and there should be no intervention in Sudan, given what the legality is nowadays?
Gentlemen there.
Yeah, I had a question about the Peace Building Commission, which I think many of us thought was one of the most interesting and innovative proposals put forward by the high-level panel. The panel, I suspect, deliberately set out a range of options for how the commission might work. Do you personally favour giving that commission a very wide remit, stretching right across the spectrum from preventative action through to post-conflict peace building? And how do you envisage the mechanism being set in place for selecting and choosing people to serve on the commission?
Gentlemen there.
Very quickly, what sort of role do you see for so-called middle power countries like Canada, Australia, Sweden in the future of global governance?
Mm-hmm. Two quick questions. One is, do you think that the development role that was managed by UN has been taken by the IMF? And the second one is, the former policies for development, there was the SAPs, has been failed. Would you say that PRSP has a significant change?
Would I say that what, sorry?
What has changed?
PRSPs, the new policies made by the...
What policy?
PRSP, Poverty Reduction Strategies.
Oh, got that.
Thank you.
Dead on arrival. But that's my view, not his. He's a diplomat. He has to be careful. Yes. Okay, that's it.
Okay, how do you make sure that countries pay their pledges? A very good question, which I was deeply conscious of all those years I was foreign minister, when I went to God knows how many of these sort of conferences and saw people playing games from which my own government was not immune, I have to say, of double promising the same amount 2, 3, 4 different times in different packages and so on. There's an awful lot of stuff like this goes on. I think there's only two answers to this. One, better institutional process in terms of the international management of this. Hopefully the Peace Building Commission will be part of the answer to that, because to sustain donor attention over time and follow through is a critical necessity. And the other part of the answer is simply to shame more effectively those countries who don't match up to their obligations. Now, there's always a reluctance to do that in international affairs, but there ought to be more of it. Use of force criteria, how would they apply to Kosovo and now Sudan? It's always dangerous to get into this without a very full discussion, but a quick snapshot response is, in the case of Kosovo, I personally think all those criteria would have been satisfied. The missing ingredient was not the legitimacy side of the house, it was the legality, because the Security Council didn't come to the party because of the Russian threatened veto. But if you work your way through all the other elements of it, a pretty formidable case can be made. And interestingly, I think if that had gone to the General Assembly using the Uniting for Peace process and so on, not least because an Islamic country and so on was involved, might well have had a clear-cut majority there, which wouldn't have conferred formal legality on it, but sure as hell would have given it a lot of political cover. I didn't answer, by the way, the question earlier on about the Middle East representation in the Security Council. I should have. The present arrangements are between the Africa and the Asia groups are that there's always at least one Islamic country on the Security Council under the present rotation arrangements, and I imagine there's a fair chance of that continuing under Model B that we proposed for a sequential capacity for renewed terms. Of course, what Egypt is arguing for in the context of the Model A and the 6 permanent seats, 2 from Africa, is that one of them should go to Egypt in order to give the Arab-Islamic world sort of permanent representation which would otherwise lack. That's a view being contested, as you might imagine, by Nigeria and South Africa, and so that issue is not yet resolved. It simply wasn't possible or very sensible to try and bring out a group of Arab-Islamic states as a group in its own right. That it was just too difficult given the cross-cutting cleavages in terms of other grouping arrangements and so on. But that's the answer. We just hope that informal arrangements will guarantee that. Coming back to the current set of questions, on Sudan, in terms of intervention there, I think the huge difficulty is not so much in some of the threshold criteria, which might well be satisfied, but the sheer impossibility, I think, of contemplating an effective military operation over a country the size of France with the kind of resources that are available. I think the present repertoire of responses, which is a civilian protection mandate for a decently constituted force combined with a serious impunity exercise, a really serious impunity exercise, and that does mean the International Criminal Court, frankly, combined with some other targeted sanctions, combined with the no-fly zone properly enforced, I mean, probably this would be good enough. So it might be a case of the last resort criteria not being satisfied, apart from the balance of consequences one, which is a difficult one to argue out. But all we're saying is there's no push-button responses on these things, but it does concentrate minds and increases the chance of consensus. Peace-building commission, to have those criteria. On the peace-building commission, how wide should its remit be? We expressed it quite broadly in terms of not only post-conflict peace-building situations, but also pre-conflict ones. The class of countries eligible for
attention by the Commission is obviously much more easily defined if you stick to the post-conflict thing, and there is a degree of developing country neurosis about the notion that countries at large might be candidates for suitable peace-building commission treatment before they clearly satisfy criteria of having been in conflict and emerging from it. As a practical matter, it might accordingly be that it will take some time for anyone to be identified in that former category in the prevention mode. Maybe the best way of doing it is just to make it voluntary. Let the commission find its feet in the more obvious post-conflict cases. Let people see that it's an organisation which is genuinely helpful and not intended to be ugly and intrusive. And then maybe others will come aboard. But that may be one of the dogs that come off the sled in the stages of negotiation. It might just end up being confined. But what we wanted to do was to systematically address the whole problem of failing fragile states, which is by no means confined to post-conflict states, although they are clearly the prime examples. On the composition of the Peace Building Commission, what we were basically arguing for was, we didn't so much leave it up in the air as say the composition will need to be varied depending on the nature of the issue being addressed. And this is a variable geometry sort of structure, which could meet at the highest policy level, Secretary General, President of the World Bank, when big policy issues relating to peace building are being discussed, for example, debt relief, say, but would more often meet in country configuration, would be structured to deal with particular country situations or on a sub-regional situation. In each case, the relevant players would be the primary people involved, the relevant regional organisation, the relevant donors, the relevant IFIs and so on, and hopefully this can be negotiated. There's quite a strong mood of support for this. There's a bit of reflex resistance around the place for those who never want to be a suitable case for treatment by any institution whatsoever, but most people see this as a gap in the existing governance institutional system and one demanding crying out to be filled. Middle powers, role of Canada, Australia, Sweden. Well, Australia's role these days is a matter of deep and abiding disappointment to me, and I won't comment on that so long as I remain in exile under the present governing arrangements. But the truth of the matter is that Canada, Sweden, countries like Australia can play a hugely significant role in these issues simply because we don't frighten anybody with either our military power or our economic power. And with a bit of creative imagination and fast, sort of footwork in coalition building, can be prime movers in the international community on a lot of these issues. And indeed, it's interesting to see the way the middle power countries are being the most active enthusiasts for this multilateral system reform, as so often in New York and elsewhere. Question about IMF was well-based. I mean, any serious attempt at global governance reform has to address not only the other institutions I mentioned more immediately within the UN family, but also those alongside it, like the IMF and the bank, in terms of their governing process and the composition of the executive boards and so on. This can be almost as hard to pull off, of course, as reform of the veto in the Security Council itself, because of the way the voting is there weighted at the moment, the way those institutions work. But generally, I think their game is being significantly lifted in the way in which they contribute positively to these aspirations, but more remains to be done. I don't have a view about poverty reduction strategies, whether they can be made to work or not. I know Jeffrey Sachs has a hugely enthusiastic view about it. I know people like Meg Dowd are profoundly sceptical. It's important to make the point, however, that however you move forward on this meeting these development goals, it does have to be somehow internally generated as well as externally applied, and it's how you mobilise it, that internal commitment to the process, that is one of the hardest nuts to crack, but one of the most critical.
Well, thank you for that, Gareth. I think the question of what the middle-income countries should do, if you look at the whole series of reports which have underpinned the high-level committee, it's Canada and Australia, and so have been playing the important role of the intellectual firepower in this thing. And I think, as Gareth said, they don't frighten anybody, but they worry like hell about the international system. And they don't mess it up either. So they kind of are are like an NGO group. They can look around. They're there. They look after and despair and so on. Anyway, I want to bring this thing to a close. I really want to thank you very much for taking us through what is a very, very complex report, all this only 93 pages or whatever it is, and also for answering the questions with such patience and such detail. Thank you very much. I know everybody now wants to ask questions, but as a rule of a public lecture says, the more unsatisfied questioners are left, the better the lecture has been. Thank you.
Thank you.